When Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land. The name of the other was Eleazar, for the God of my father, said he, was mine help, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness, where he encamped at the Mount of God. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee, and thy wife and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and did obeisance, and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly he was above them. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God, and Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before the Lord. Well, it began a couple of years ago. At the end of a particular year, I sat down and counted the top 10 bad things that had happened in that year, and it wasn't very hard for me to find 10 of them. And I confess that was a bad thing for me to do. So for this year, I decided that I was going to do a top 5, bottom 5 list, the top 5 things that happened, the bottom 5 things that happened. And again, it wasn't very hard to find the bottom 5 things. The top 5 things, of course, required my mind to use some neural pathways that, well, let's just put it this way, had grown some cobwebs over time. For all the tragic occurrences that have occurred last year, some good things did happen, and very good things when I reflect upon them. And I think that my struggle with that tells us something about the way that most of our minds function, and calls us to analyze whether this is a biblical and right way for us to think. For forcing our minds through those neglected exercises of thinking of things positive that have happened in the last year, I believe help us to see that even the tragedies of the past year have had some redeeming qualities. This story is a story of remembrance. And I suggest to you that it challenges our normal way of looking at the past. Many commentators think that the position of this story has been moved forward from a later chronological event in order to produce a contrast between chapter 17 and chapter 18. In chapter 17, you have a non-Israelite group represented by the Amalekites who come in a hostile way against Israel. And they say in chapter 18, you have another non-Israelite person or group that come to Israel and to the camp for a positive purpose. And so this contrast is being revealed. The story, though, certainly provides an interlude, a pause before we go up the mountain, shall we say, in a kind of literal tongue-in-cheek side of way, since in chapter 19 we get to Mount Sinai and everything that happens at Mount Sinai. Almost the rest of the book of the Exodus takes place there at the foot of Mount Sinai. These 12 verses, I think, fit with our present time. As we enter into this new year, let us look back at 2021, seeing not what our sin-tainted mind would cause us to see, but seeing what God would have us to see. Let us look back and learn and look forward with biblical eyes. And this story takes us through 3 events I want us to look at: reunion, retelling, and rejoicing. reunion, retelling, and rejoicing. The story begins with a reunion. This passage has a lot of questions and unclear aspects to it, and yet through all of the questions that we cannot answer, the vision given to us presents lessons for living. We see first the reunion here between Moses and his father-in-law with his wife and sons. We begin with Jethro, introduced again in verse 1. When Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. We left Jethro back in chapter 4, when Moses, after meeting God on the mount and the burning bush, goes to Jethro, and we read this in chapter 4, verse 18. Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said unto him, "Let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, to see whether they be yet alive." And Jethro said unto Moses, "Go in peace." From this verse, we have no indication of how the message came to Jethro about the condition of Israel and Moses. All we know is that Jethro is the priest in Midian and Moses' father-in-law. I was struck as we were reading that this morning how often Moses' father-in-law keep showing up again and again and again throughout this chapter wherever Jethro is mentioned. He is always has that appellation, Moses' father-in-law. And make sure you don't forget what Jethro this is. But we don't know how Jethro comes to know what has happened in the story of the Exodus. We need not speculate that some messenger had come from Israel to Midian. This is a large group of people moving through the Sinai Peninsula, and such a large group of people moving through territory would certainly be marked along with the story of why these people are in this place where the shepherds who would take their flocks around this would not expect them to be. All the nomadic people, all of a sudden there's this great big camp. Well, where did they come from? And the word would have spread. While perhaps not indicative of Jethro's conclusions of the story, we have the summary about what Jethro heard. He heard of all that God had done for Moses, all that God had done for Israel. Notice, it is Israel, his people. God has a unique relationship with them, and all that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Well, let's skip a little bit because I want to keep our focus on this reunion with Jethro. In verse 5, we read, "And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses into the wilderness where he camped at the Mount of God. And he said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee and thy wife and her two sons with me." The people of Israel are camped in the region of the Mount of God, probably Mount Sinai. We commented last week, if you remember, that when we talked about the water coming out of the rock there at Rephidim, that there's a very good possibility that this is the water that sustains them throughout their existence and throughout their encampment around the foot of the mountain Sinai. And there, Jethro meets with them. Their camp is. And he sends an emissary to announce his presence. So we look at verse 6, it might seem to you rather shocking that Jethro says something to Moses and then he meets with Moses in the very next verse. But what we understand here is that Jethro sent a message to Moses announcing his coming. This is not like today when my parents came to visit me this past week, or the week before. They have a nice little smartphone and they can put in my address and get maps to conjure up a directions, and they can put share ETA, and I get a note on my phone whenever it tells me how long they're going to be there. And I've done that to them when I go and visit them, and so they're often waiting for me to show up when my car pulls in the parking lot, which is kind of creepy. They didn't have that back in these days, and you didn't just bounce into someone's camp if you could help it. You sent an emissary, and here Jethro is approaching the camp. He sends an emissary, letting Moses know, and so he can prepare a proper welcome for his father-in-law. And Moses does so in verse 7. "And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him, and they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent." Here, while not of Israel, Jethro has shown great kindness to Moses, and Moses treats him with reverence and respect, due not just to a father-in-law, but someone who has really helped him. Remember the story of Moses. He flees out of Egypt, and Jethro gives him a place to stay. He gives him a wife. He gives him a job. He keeps him for 40 years. And when Moses wants to go back to Egypt, Jethro doesn't stand in his way. He says, peace be with you. Even after the Exodus, we know that at some point, Zipporah and his son, and Moses' sons come back to Jethro, and Jethro has taken care of them for a while. And we cannot help but see this reunion as joyous between Moses and Jethro. Now, on the other hand, commentators have much more speculation when it arises with Zipporah and Moses' sons. Look at verse 2. When Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back and her two sons. A question arises and generates a lot of speculation. When and why did Moses send his family to Jethro? The uncritical answer often focuses on chapter 2, that after the events of chapter 2, where Zipporah and the flint knife and Gershom have a really interesting and bloody encounter, many commentators say that this is the last time you see Zipporah in the text of Scripture, and therefore she must go back at that point. However, since you rarely see Moses' wife and sons in the entirety of the book of Exodus, it's hardly very conclusive to say so. The fact of the matter is, we don't know when they returned to Jethro. We only know that they did. Calvin had a rather interesting speculation about when this occurred. He says that Zipporah and the sons stayed with Moses throughout the entirety of the Exodus event, that they were with him through all things. And he reasons this way because he said that it would seem odd to Israel for their leader to send his wife and children back in order to avoid danger, as is many people's presuppositions. And so his reconstruction is that when Israel comes out of Egypt and is going to Sinai, that Zipporah says, well, we're going right by Dad's place. I'm going to go and see Dad. And Moses says, okay, you can go see Dad. And so that's how the message comes to Jethro about what had happened in Egypt to Israel. It's a possible reconstruction, but it's hardly a very strong one. And so we are left with uncertainty. I think that is best, because the problem of assuming that Zipporah and the children go back at the end of chapter 4 is that many commentators take this as proof as of a negative relationship between Moses and his wife. It's a very difficult passage, if you can remember all the way back to when I preached on Exodus chapter 4. You remember the story. They're going toward Egypt, and Moses is threatened with death by God, and because he has not circumcised Gershom. And so Zipporah does that, and in a very interesting set of statements, she puts the remnants on his foot and says, a bloody husband you are to me, or a husband of blood you are to me, which is very controversial statement. I take a very positive view of that event, and if you need further explanation, I'll refer you back to go to the website and find that sermon and listen to it. So I don't think that there is evidence of a negative or a breach in the marriage between Zipporah and Moses. Rather, that this is a joyous reunion. And in fact, consider the positive statements that are made here of Moses' sons. Look at verse 2 and 3, or 3 and 4. And her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land, and the other is Eleazar, for the God of my father said he was mine help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Gershom seems slightly negative, if you think about it, as Moses saying, I am an alien in a strange land here in this land with Jethro. But it might be, as Eleazar's name is, looking back. Because Eleazar is definitely looking back. The Lord was my help when I was in Egypt. But if Gershom's idea is looking back, I was an alien and a stranger in the land of Egypt, just as my people Israel are, but now I have found a home. And so you can look at both of these names in a very positive light. Some commentators with a negative view of the relationship between Moses and his wife make much of the fact that their reunion isn't made much of. You hear a lot about Jethro and Moses meeting one another, kissing one another, talking to one another, but you don't hear about Moses meeting with Zipporah, Gershom, or Eliezer. They say, well, this proves that there's some problems in the family. And I don't think that's necessarily true. Again, you don't hear a lot about Zipporah, Eliezer, or Gershom at all, and that's not uncommon in the Old Testament. So there's no evidence of a begrudging reunion. We have little to suppose that this was anything other than a joyous time for this family. But as I reflected upon this, I thought about this reality that family reunions take work. Now, they don't necessarily take a lot of work, but they take some effort. You rarely reunite with your family by accident. If I want to reunite my family, it takes planning. I have to get in the car, I have to throw all of the dog and all of her accoutrement in the car, and I have to drive. But it takes an effort. It doesn't happen by accident. If you consider the times when you've reunited with your family for the past year, I would suggest that they usually didn't occur by accident. Sometimes it takes work. Sometimes it takes a lot of work. And sometimes there are some separations that cannot be breached. So I want to ask you a question about this reunion. Does the Bible seem to focus upon the separation between Moses and Jethro or on their reunion? I think the answer is rather self-evident. The focus of the passage is the joy of the reunion more than the pain of separation. And I think that gives us a kind of idea about how we are to view the reunion of God's people, because every Sunday is a family reunion. Every Sunday is God's people, God's family getting together. And there ought to be a sense of joy in it. We have reunions to look back at and to give thanks for. We have reunions to look forward to. We have reunions that we ought to work for. We see not only a reunion, but we secondly see retelling. In this reunion, we briefly see the topics of conversation between specifically Moses and Jethro. They inquire about each other's welfare and warfare. I kind of like that. The latter idea is apparent because of its connection to the previous chapter. Welfare, the word appears in verse 7. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him, and they asked each other after their welfare, and they came into the tent. So Moses goes out of the camp, meets Jethro in this kind of arrangement when he's coming in. They meet each other. He goes through this procedure to greet him with reverence, and then he brings him into his tent. It's a view of family reunion and fellowship that Moses had prepared for. And they ask each other about their welfare. How have you been doing? You can imagine the kind of conversations that they might have had. It probably has been a year since these two have met each other, but since Moses left to go to Egypt. Moses will be wanting to catch up on everything that has happened to Jethro. Anybody probably knows common friends he left after 40 years of working for him. People in Jethro's camp, he still has an interest in their welfare. He'll want to converse with his wife and sons and what they have experienced and how they are doing. It's a reflection of the common talk that people have, that reunited friends and family have together. But there is a greater substance of the conversation because the welfare kind of just is passed over lightly. The focus is on the warfare. Look at verse 8. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptian for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. We find two headings under discussion in this verse. The first deals with the Lord's acts in Egypt, And the second deals with the Lord's acts during their journey in the wilderness. In Egypt, Moses probably tells Jethro the story of the plagues. But we don't know what Jethro has heard from the first verse. All he seems to know is that Israel had come out of Egypt and that something had happened to the Egyptians and Pharaoh to have caused them to be able to come out. He may not know the story of how the Exodus came to be. He may not know the story of Moses' visits to the courts of Pharaoh. He may not know about the plagues. He might not know how the Lord fought against the gods of Egypt, against Pharaoh, and against the Egyptians. He may not know how God had overthrown the Egyptians in the Red Sea. And so Moses tells Jethro the story of God's redemption of his people. And notice that the summary has this in it: all that God had done, the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake. We may think to ourselves, well, Moses, you got that wrong, because I know the first answer to the Shorter Catechism, that man's chief end is to glorify God and to joy and to forever. Everything that God does is for his own glory, but the welfare of God's people is the way that he manifests his glory. And so he really does it for the sake, for the good of his people, Israel. And this is also seen in the second section, the story of what God did for Israel in the wilderness. Moses probably tells Jethro about the works that the Lord had wrought on the way to Sinai. He probably tells them about, we were at this place called Marah, the water was bitter. The Lord showed me a tree, I cut it down, threw it in, the water was sweet. We're going through the wilderness and the people go, oh, we don't have any bread. And so God makes it rain manna for us. We came to this place where there was no water. The people were about to stone me and God showed me a rock and I hit it and the water comes out. See all this water? That's where it's coming from, this rock that I hit. But also he told them about the deliverance, the warfare against Amalek. Notice that the bad things are not ignored here in verse 8. All the travail that had come upon them by the way, and how the Lord delivered them. The deliverance of Israel out of the hands of Amalek. The bad things are not ignored, but they appear almost as if they're just foils against which the Lord is showing his sovereignty and his power. The challenges that were impossible for men to surmount, the Lord solves with seemingly effortless ease. When we think about the conversation between Moses and Jethro, we ought to ask ourselves, how often do our conversations go deeper than asking each other about our welfare? How often do we have courage enough to ask each other or to talk with each other about our warfare? The thing about our struggles is that we often think that unless you have been there, then you don't know what it is like. Unless you were there in the trenches when I suffered X, you can't know what it's like. But the truth is, we all have suffering. And yes, my suffering is not like yours. I don't know what it was like to be in the trenches with you, but I know what it's like to be in a trench. I know what it's like to endure pain. And God gives his people the capacity for empathy so that we may discuss our warfare, not because we want to show each other the scars of battle, but because we want to tell the story, not of the warfare, but of the victory that God gives his people. We cannot let the struggle be the end of the story. The story is not finally about the struggle, but of the Lord's victory. These are the stories we want to tell. The story that the Lord has delivered us. But they still require courage to talk about. Because I think we all have a place that we don't want to share with others. And in it lies all of our insecurities, the places where we struggle, the places where we want to see the victory. The places where the Lord gives his people victory. We don't want people to know that we struggle. We don't want to know that we desperately need the power of God when we run up against the impossible to us. Because those are the stories that Moses was telling. We were at this place. It had bitter water, and I didn't know what to do. And God told me to cut down a tree and throw it in. I couldn't have figured that out. We were at this place, and the people wanted bread. I can't give them bread. So the Lord made it rain bread. We were at this place, and the people wanted water, and I couldn't give them water. And the Lord showed me this rock. We were at this place, and these people were attacking us. They were really nasty people. They were attacking the weak and the hindmost. And the Lord sent a group out to go fight with them. And when I put my hands up, we won. When I put my hands down, we lost. And I couldn't keep my hands up. So the Lord had two people there to keep my hands up for me. The story is always about Moses' inability and God's deliverance. These are the stories that are worth telling and retelling because they lead to rejoicing. God's people respond to the story of the Lord's powerful deliverance with rejoicing. And this is the model we have in this passage. We see that rejoicing apparent in both word and worship. First, we hear the profession of Jethro in verses 9 and 10. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptian. And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." Notice the repeated reference to the hand of Israel's oppressors. Why does Jethro keep talking about the hand of the Egyptians, the hand of Pharaoh, the hand of everybody? Is he just preoccupied with hands? No, but it's because there is a distinction, there is a contest going on between the hand of everyone else and the hand of the Lord. Deuteronomy 4:34, Moses will talk about that. By temptations, by signs, by wonders, by war, and by a mighty hand, and by a stretched out arms, and by great terrors, according to all the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes. The hand of Pharaoh, the hand of the Egyptians, could not withstand, could not stop or hinder the hand of the Lord. From the great repetition of the acts of the Lord, the Jethro moves on to a personal statement in verse 11. "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods." The first part of this verse is complex for interpretive reasons. The second part of the verse is complex for grammatical reasons. The first verse, does Jethro affirm allegiance to the Lord alone, or does this show a polytheistic belief? The Lord is greater than all the other gods who exist, but this one is greater. Some have affirmed so, but I suggest we don't have sufficient evidence in this verse. As the priests of Midian, we cannot assume either answer. The Jewish commentator Casuto will make much of the unique wording of the next verse, verse 12, to say that he accepts the polytheistic explanation, but that argument is not incontrovertible. At least we can say that Jethro sees the superiority of the Lord over against all other powers. Because the emphasis of what Jethro is saying is on the sovereignty and the superiority of God. It's not about polytheism. The latter part of this verse is complex for grammatical reasons. You can read it in any translation you want. It's still going to be a problem in the Authorized Version. It is, "For in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them." Literally, the Hebrew reads, "For in the word," or "in the thing, which they acted proudly over them." And the problem, part of the problem is that there you have two third-person plural pronouns which have very difficult antecedents. because they might be the same, but they don't really fit being the same. The KJV tries to make them both the same, but it has to assume some things. If you looked in there, when it says, "For in the thing wherein he dealt proudly, he was above them." He was is put in italics because they're saying, well, we had to add these words to make sense of this thing. It seems better to see these third-person pronouns as referring to two different groups of people. But even at that, it's still difficult. The idea seems to be that the first group of people were acting arrogantly against the second group of people. Therefore, the second group of people is probably Israel. But who are the first group of people? Is it the Egyptians, which would take the antecedent from verse 10, or the closer plural noun, which is gods, at the beginning of verse 11. Some consider it either way. Either way, the point of the verse is significant. The Lord responds against those who arrogantly presume to enslave his people. These people belong to the Lord, and he has acted to demonstrate his superiority against any who would enslave them, be it the Egyptians or be it their gods. And this confession leads to worship in verse 12. "And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God." Some see this story brought forward because of the names of the sacrifices. Some have said that this must be a later event that is brought forward because the name of the sacrifices doesn't exist yet. Moses is going to be told about the sacrifices on Mount Sinai. The problem with this is that sacrifices have already appeared in the Bible. And also, it was not impossible that God would use existing sacrificial mechanisms in his own worship, just as he does with circumcision. The other problem mentioned earlier, noted by Kizuto, is that in this verse, you have a unique change. In this verse, you have the word God, Elohim, replacing the tetragrammaton, the covenant name of God. Usually, it is sacrifices before the Lord. In fact, Kizuto notes that everywhere sacrifices are mentioned in the Torah, in Moses' writings, when it's a sacrifice before the Lord, it is sacrifice before the Lord. This is the only time that it is a sacrifice before God. Now, he suggested that makes much of it that it is a Gentile sacrifice, and therefore it is being set apart by this unique word. And while that is an interesting speculation, it is certainly not conclusive. What we do see here is Jethro identifying with the faith of and the worship of the Lord. We see the fellowship of him with the Lord's people. He has confessed his faith in the Lord. The Lord is above all gods. You see him worshiping before God. And you see him fellowshipping not only with Moses, but with Aaron and the elders before God as well. To every person, just as before, as it occurred to Jethro, there comes a moment of decision. Jethro heard what the Lord did for Israel and subsequently declared his excellence. To you, a moment of decision comes today. More than a deliverance from Egypt, I am here to tell you that you faced a greater slavery. You were a bondage to evil, to sin. And I am not telling you anything that you do not already know. After all, did Israel need to be told that they were slaves in Egypt? You may try to deny your brokenness. You may try to deny your sin, the evil that is within your heart, but it is something that you may suppress but not completely ignore. Just as no one was there and no one could save Israel from Egypt, God sent a deliverer. I proclaim to you the deliverance and the deliverer, that God visited Israel in Egypt, but God visited us in Jesus. Jesus is God come to earth, born as a man who lived the sinless, perfectly good life that was necessary for us to live with God. He died on the cross for our sin, for our guilt, for the evil that we have done, for the brokenness that is within. He paid the penalty that our crimes deserved against God, the wrath of God due to us for sin, and he rose from the dead, affirming that our debt had been fully paid. Today is the day of decision. Today I call upon you to answer this question. Do you believe that what Jesus did, he did for you? My friend, repent of your sin and follow after Jesus. Christian, as we think about this passage, about the sacrifices, about the fellowship that happened at the end of it, you cannot but help see a connection to the Lord's Supper. As the family of God gathered at their peace offering, so we gather at the Lord's table. We rejoice in what he has done with us. We rejoice in the deliverance that he has wrought for us. We rejoice at him and his sovereignty above all other powers. There is a rejoicing that we are to do throughout all of our life, and I suggest to you that it requires us to look back and see aright. And for that, I'm going to tell a personal story. Most afternoons, around 4 o'clock, if you want to find me, then I will be outside with Connie, taking her on a walk by the river. I have two routes I take with the dog. The morning one is the long one, and the afternoon one is rather short. And I have, in the last few months, I guess, decided I am going to adjust the Bennett calendar, and I sit at the bank of the river. Dog runs around and does what dogs do. Actually, she's gotten to the point where she just kind of hangs around me asking to be pet. And I sit there and I contemplate life and I pray. And yesterday I was there and I was thinking about the new year and the words of a song captured how I think many of us approach the new year. And I thought I'd put it in my sermon because it's the way that we think about looking back. And we don't look forward in terms of rejoicing because I suggest to you that we look back and we think wrongly. The past has taught us to think about our own past and to close our eyes against the future so as not to see the inevitable evil that faces us. And I suggest we need to assess how we view the past and if that fits with the Bible's call for us to see things. Because if you think about what the Bible is, it doesn't hide the suffering of God's people in the past, but it's always about God's power over it. It's always about God's deliverance of his people from it. It's always not looking at everything that went wrong and leaving it there, but everything that was wrong that God brought us through. The past gives us reasons for thanksgiving and rejoicing. I was on that bank and I prayed for something and I thought to my, and later that night as I woke up at, I don't know what it was, 3 o'clock, because the dog had to go outside, because you know that's what dogs have to do. And it was almost as if I had this thought process running through my mind about the question, do you really believe that what you prayed for is going to occur? Do you believe that, considering all that you know theologically, that you believe that God is going to give you what you ask for? Do you have thanksgiving, understanding that God has given you things in the past, and are you going to rejoice in the future for what God has done for you? I had to come to the point in which I said, I don't want to say no. And so I borrowed, as I normally do, thieved, if you want, from the New Testament. When Jesus approached the guy with the son who was demon-possessed, he said, everything is possible to those who believe. And he said, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. I know what I'm supposed to believe. I know what I'm supposed to think. I know what how I'm supposed to look at the past and how I'm supposed to look to the future. How I should be rejoicing and should be giving thanks. But for what I have seen, it's hard for me to do. It will be a challenge throughout this next year to keep rejoicing. We will face sorrows. We will face suffering, we will face struggles, we will face temptations. And that is not uncommon to God's people throughout the history of God's people. But if this passage is telling us anything, it is telling us that God is above it, that God is sovereign. God is over all powers, and when the powers think arrogantly to drive God's people down, God shows up and visits them and delivers them. The focus of our attention ought not to be the hard times, but the way the Lord delivers us out of them. It is a question of perspective. It is a question of the things that we look for. What are you going to be looking for in 2022? Will you be looking for the problems? Or will you be looking for the power of the Lord that will be operating in and through His people? It will be there. The Lord will work through His people in this next year, in this year. The question is, what are you going to pay attention to? Let's pray together. Lord our God, as we come before You this morning, we confess how easy it is for us to be swayed by the messages that surround us, by the way that people think, to think that You have been dethroned, to think that the problems are all that is, instead of thinking about the way in which You have delivered Your people. We pray that we would look forward in faith, knowing what You have done for us. So let us look back and give thanks for the way in which You have delivered us, that we may rejoice with full hearts. Hear our prayer for Jesus' sake. Amen. I invite you to turn in your hymnals to hymn 635. Hymn 635, How Good It Is to Thank the Lord. Let us stand together as we sing hymn 635.